collect things, and how much is too much? Join me, Annabelle Crabb, as I venture into the secret stacks of the State Library of New South Wales and discover that most of the collection isn't books at all. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
On a deserted shoreline in South Australia in 1802, two ships are facing off. One bears a Union Jack flag, the other, the French tricolour. These two nations have spent the last century bickering, and the Napoleonic Wars are on the horizon. It seems like a battle is on. But then a white flag of truce rises from the British ship. A few moments later, a British flag is hoisted up a pole on the French ship. This is how Nicolas Baudin and Matthew Flinders, two commanders and navigators, say, "Hail, fellow, well met." Or I guess as we'd say today, "Hi there, no hard feelings. Don't worry about the fact that our countries don't like each other very much." But when Flinders boards Baudin's vessel, he finds him less than pleased. He's lost nine of his best crew while sailing around the Bass Strait, and he's blaming Flinders. Well, specifically, the map that Flinders created with ship surgeon slash best mate slash potential lover, George Bass. So what does Flinders do? He says that it's Bass who's responsible for the dodgy cartography. And Flinders instead promises to give his new French friend, Baudin, some more recent maps. That offer smooths things over. The battle is averted. Both men go on their merry ways, sailing the seas around this continent. But this will not be the last time that Flinders' fate is entwined with the French. Hello, I'm Alicia Simmons.
And I'm Lee Boucher, and this is The Dead Can't Sue. And we're a couple of very serious historians simply letting loose in an ABC studio, gossiping about dead people from Australia's past because, well, it's in the name. They can't sue.
Thank goodness for that.
Each week, we're poking around in the entrails of Australian history, telling the stories of the people who've shaped and misshaped our country, whether you've heard of them or not.
And this is the second ever episode of our podcast. And if you're wondering who on earth we are and what gives us the right to talk about Flinders and suggest that his relationship with Bass was more than platonic, we urge you to listen to last week's episode.
But to summarise for those unwilling to do the required homework, last week, we met the young Matthew Flinders. He was born in England in 1774. Having read the tales of Robinson Crusoe, Flinders rejects his father's plan for him of becoming a surgeon and seeks adventure instead. He takes to the sea, entering the Royal Navy. Importantly, at least for me, he looks a little like Timothy Chalamet.
He does indeed. In 1795, he ends up on an exploratory expedition of the Reliance, which is a ship bound for Port Jackson, a.k.a. Sydney Harbour.
And that's where the meet cute occurred, right? With that ship surgeon, George Bass, who's really good with his hands.
Very good with his hands. That's true, Lee. They meet, they hit it off, and when they arrive in Australia, they decide to, and I quote, "complete an examination of the east coast of New South Wales."
And together. Maybe a little bit each other too.
Navigate each other's hearts. Many hijinks ensue. They circumnavigate Tasmania and go on a bit of an obnoxious naming spree, giving names to all sorts of places that obviously, as we know, already had Indigenous names. So that brings us to 1800 and a very steamy letter that Flinders penned to Bass. We did discuss it last week. This week, however, we have, firstly, circumnavigation. We have an homage to a cat. We have a long stint as a prisoner of war in Mauritius. Spoiler alert, that's where the pesky French return. We have another romantic clandestine frisson. And then Flinders' death literally the day after his life's work was published.
Okay, this guy's life seems just designed for a novel. Let's get into it.
It is a fabulous yarn. Okay, it's 1801 and Flinders is promoted to commander. Mazel tov to you, Flinders. He's now age 26. He publishes the findings of his expeditions in a book which wins him acclaim. He writes to Joseph Banks, the famous botanist and his patron now, saying that his further exploration of Australia needs to be done. And he is the man for the job. Okay, so he leaves Britain on the 20th of July, 1801, now aged 27, as a commander in the ship called the Investigator, carrying a scientific passport.
So Bass, okay. Is he on this ship as well?
Look, this is the sad part, right? You know, if you listen to episode one, there seems to be an erotic attachment that you can definitely read between them. But no.
Yeah, okay.
There is no Bass to be seen. And Flinders is clearly sad about this. So he writes, "Of the assistance of my able friend Bass, I was, however, deprived." Mm. Bass had joined a commercial expedition in 1799, taking sealskins from Tasmania to China. Flinders, and this is the other part of Bass just being a bit of an asshole to him, really, he told Bass that he really wanted to go on a commercial expedition together. But Bass didn't think that Flinders had a mind for commerce, and so he organised it instead without him.
Oof.
Oh, rejected.
Yeah, sure.
And then insult to injury, Bass then marries Elizabeth Waterhouse. So he gets married anyway.
So Bass is kind of, he's moving on. It feels like he's moving on.
Yeah, I get the feeling with Bass that everyone's a bit in love with him and he has lots of options there and he has fun with Flinders. He kind of plays with him like a cat with a, you know, ball of twine, and then he goes, done, and stalks out of the room.
Look, I have been wondering this whole time, who is the f*** boy in this story? And at first I thought it was Flinders, but now maybe it's Bass.
I think that's a really important historical question to ask me, and one that we'll probably go back to. Okay, so he's scarcely out of the British Channel before he notices a leak in the Investigator in his ship, as well as rotted spars and defective rigging.
Okay. He's only out of the British Channel and the ship's already in trouble. What's going on here?
I know. Do we blame Flinders? In fact, in this instance, I don't think we do. The world is at war. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, France and Britain are constantly at war in the 18th century, in the 19th century. His ships are generally really shit because of the war. Okay, so the best vessels went to battle with France and he basically got the duds.
Yeah.
So despite the shit ship, Flinders arrives on the southwestern coast of Australia in 1802, where he has encounters with local First Nation groups. And he also meets Nicolas Baudin in this time. And that's the French explorer, similar scientific expedition to Flinders, sponsored by Napoleon. That's the person who we started the episode with. And the place that they meet is aptly called, to this day, Encounter Bay. So
that's named for their encounter with each other.
That is named for their encounter with each other, although obviously, as we'll get to, there's a lot of other encounters going on, primarily with First Nations people and between First Nations people. All right, so once in Sydney, Flinders gets a crew together to complete his circumnavigation of Australia. It includes a Garigal man named Bungary, who he describes as, and I quote, worthy and brave, and a Gadigal man named Nanbury, described as a good-natured lad.
Okay, so how does Flinders convince these two Indigenous blokes to get on a ship and travel around the continent?
He looks like Timothée Chalamet.
Yeah, of course.
Like, obviously, you know. Who would say no?
Yeah,
Bass. Yeah, I know. That just tells you how hot Bass is.
Yeah.
Look, basically, it's an interesting story with Bungary. He was raised around the area of what today is Nora Head. Nora Head is about an hour and a half up the central coast from Sydney. He moves down to Sydney and immediately learns English very quickly, you know, picks it up, becomes a cross-cultural negotiator as well. And he'd actually previously sailed with Flinders on a 60-day round trip to Norfolk Island on the Reliance in 1798. And Flinders was so impressed with Bungary's friendly demeanour, his intuition and his bravery that the following year he takes him on a coastal survey, voyage to Bribie Island, so up to Queensland on another boat. And the Australian Museum, who've written quite a lot about Bungary, their site's fantastic, they say that he was a brilliant diplomat and despite language barriers could quickly ascertain the wishes of the coastal Aboriginal groups that they encounter. So Flinders uses him again on his most exploratory voyage, the circumnavigation of Australia, in the Investigator from 1802 to 1803. And it's on that voyage that most of Australia's coastline is mapped. And I think that that's an interesting thing to think about is the fact that it's not just Flinders who doesn't necessarily know the language of and know the customs of the various Indigenous mm-hmm. groups that he's meeting. It's also Bungari. So on his boat, Flinders has Bungari. Nanbury actually mm-hmm. returns to Sydney. And we also have on his boat one of my favourite characters in Australian history, and that's Flinders' cat, Trim. And Trim is named after a character in Tristram Shandy. He's a small black cat with white paws who he describes as, in classic Flinders terms, the sporting, affectionate and useful companion of my voyages. In 1807, when he's in Mauritius and has a lot more time on his hands, he just pens this most adorable biography, this homage to Trim, which goes on to make Trim possibly one of the most famous cats, I would say, in history.
I was really interested in the fact that you used the word, and maybe Flinders did too, a biography of Trim. We would usually only use the word biography about a human.
Absolutely. And this is one of the joys, can I say, of doing a biography podcast right now mm-hmm. is that how we understand biography as historians is exploding.
Yeah, you know, sure.
And that is partly, I think, to do with the increasing voices and narratives that we're getting from Indigenous people.
Yeah.
So you can now have, for instance, a biography of an ocean, a biography of a mountain mm-hmm. might be possible, and the way that we're telling them is different. So this is the way he tells that biography of Trim. He goes, Trim, though vain, was not like those young men who, being assured of an independence, spend their youth in idle trifling. He was, on the contrary, animated with a noble zeal for the improvement of his faculties. So, like other ship cats, he'd protect the food from rats, and he also formed this really close bond with Bungari, which I really love. So Flinders says that in the expedition that he makes to examine the northern parts of the coast of New South Wales, and this is Flinders' words, Trim presented a request to be part of the party, promising to take upon himself the defence of our bread bags, and his services were accepted. Bungari, an intelligent native of Port Jackson, was also on board our little sloop, and with Trim, he formed an intimate acquaintance. If he had occasion to drink, he mewed to Bungari and leapt up to the water cask. If to eat, he called him down below and went straight to his kid, where there was generally a remnant of a black swan. In short, Bungari was his great resource, and his kindness was repaid with caresses.
Oh.
Isn't it so sweet? You know, with someone like Flinders, I myself have written about him in relation to all of his friendships.
Mm-hmm.
And when I wrote that article, probably about 15 years ago now,
yeah.
I left out Trim.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and Trim is absolutely crucial. It was a real mistake.
Yeah. So this is sounding like a pretty idyllic traipse up the eastern coast of Australia. He's got Trim. He's got a very competent diplomat in Bungari. Is it a good time?
I mean, any time on a ship in the late 18th, early 19th century, probably not always described as a good time.
Yep.
I mean, look, I can add to the joyful part of it, though, is that they're going up to the Great Barrier Reef. Okay, so on the one hand, they're looking into the ocean, and I love actually the way that explorers describe the oceans at these times. And this is what Flinders says. He says, oh, we had wheat sheaves, mushrooms, staghorns, cabbage leaves, a variety of other forms. You know, all the things that we see in glass-bottom boats today, they're just looking down into the ocean, seeing that. They've got fish leaping out. Fish are constantly leaping out
sure.
of the ocean onto these boats, which says a lot about the degradation of our fish, you know, stocks at the moment as a result of climate change. But while contemplating the richness of the scene, he says, we could not long forget with what destruction it was pregnant.
Right.
Okay. And so it's not long before they run aground.
Yeah.
Okay. The reef is really perilous. It's really hazardous for navigators. They end up losing three anchors. The Lady Nelson, which is a companion boat to the Big Boy, lost a keel. They continue to run aground in reefs. And at one point, they were taking in water at 5 inches per hour. He labelled the area the Great Barrier Reefs, and it was the first time that this name was actually formally attached.
Oh, I've learned something. I've learned something today. I didn't realise that's where the name came from.
Great Barrier Reef and also Australia, we remember last time.
Yeah.
That's Flinders. Okay, so he continues north around Groot Eland and Arnhem Land and the Gulf of Carpentaria. He has more encounters with Indigenous people that are helped by Bungaree.
So I remember from episode one, we'd set up a shaving station. Like, I think that was down near Wollongong. He went ashore and was like, let's set up a little barbershop. Is he setting up barbershops across the northern coast of Australia? Is that what's going on?
Can I just say barbershops are so popular amongst all British people at this time. William Dawes, the astronomer and the linguist, surveyor, is also operating one out at Dawes Point, which is still Dawes Point today in Sydney. One of his favourite clients is a guy that we'll chat about in this show, Benelong. Loves to get his beard cut. Not just that, there's various ways. You've got to imagine encounter as a moment where you have Indigenous people and Europeans at this stage who cannot speak a word of each other's language. So they've been described as a kind of dumb show. This is a place of pantomime. It's a place of creative misunderstandings, you know, between each other. They don't have any shared language. But what they do have is bodies, okay? They have bodies, they have curiosity. So one of the things that the British actually often do is take their clothes off.
Yeah, sure. Proving that they're human? Is that the sort of...
It's proving that they're human. It's also at the request often of Indigenous people who are curious about their gender.
Yeah.
They're constantly giving out handkerchiefs. They give out trinkets and baubles and, you know.
So there's an established practice actually here. So in one sense it's creative misunderstanding, it's two groups trying to figure out how to communicate. But actually both these groups have ways of encountering that precede this particular encounter. The British are bringing traditions of encounter, and I'm sure the Indigenous groups are bringing traditions of encounter as well.
Absolutely, and gifting is a big part of that. Flinders gets some Scots on board to perform a Highland jig. In another instance, he gets them to line up in their red coats and do a military drill, and the locals apparently love it. But let's also not romanticise this. There is also violence. I mean, one of these places is called Skirmish Point. It's interesting thinking about it. There's a historian called I.C. Campbell who wrote a kind of groundbreaking article called The Culture of Culture Contact. And he said, we have to stop thinking about this as one culture bringing their culture in its complete form to the other culture, who is also operating in their culture in complete form. Instead, he says, let's think about this moment of encounter as a third culture, as a space where neither of them are actually within their own cultures, you know, at that time.
They're both on the beach.
They're on the beach, in the words of Greg Denny.
Yeah. And sort of finding their way to a third space in a sort of slightly incoherent way, slightly misunderstanding way. That's a really beautiful way of kind of understanding this moment. But I did note you mentioned these encounters can go all kinds of different ways. They can go well or they can go badly, hence Skirmish Point. So it's really interesting as an historian, you know, primarily of 19th century Australia, I'm used to understanding encounters between Indigenous Australians and settlers as controlling one way, even if there is agency and Indigenous people are finding ways to survive, that there's not a lot of curiosity in the kind of 19th century imagination. It does feel like this encounter has a sense of curiosity to it.
Absolutely, which is fundamental to it being an 18th century encounter rather than a missionary arriving with their Bible going, I'm going to give you civilization and completely reconfigure your soul, which happens more in the 19th century. The other thing that I really want to point out with this, though, is that it's also an encounter between Bungaree and these people. Okay, so often we centre the European in these narratives and we talk about European and, you know, Indigenous relations. What I really love about this is that firstly, it disrupts that heroic narrative that we have around Flinders. It instead says that exploration is very much a collaborative enterprise. There's a lot of people playing their part in this, crucially, Aboriginal people. Bungaree is the first person anytime they arrive somewhere who goes down onto the shore. Flinders sends him out. It's Bungaree who goes first to broker, you know, a peace relation with the people and to try to talk to them, not in his own language. You know, so you have that. You also have the extent then of to which curiosity is not just something that Europeans have. I think Bungaree was curious. You know, there's a reason why he's constantly signing up for these ships. He's enjoying it.
Yeah.
So by the time the crew in Arnhem land, they're exhausted. Many of them are unwell, and the investigator is still leaking. So Flinders, as the captain, decides to turn back to Port Jackson, mm-hmm. or Sydney Harbour, to get a proper vessel. But he does this via the West Coast, which is how he completes his circumnavigation.
So that's a lesser heroic kind of circumnavigation than, like, whipping back to Port Jackson with your tail between your legs and a leaky boat.
I love it. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, every time that I always imagined that circumnavigation, I always imagined it as a kid being done all at once, mm-hmm. you know, and actually that's not the case. It was kind of a bit of a patchwork and ultimately, as you say, beautifully, unheroic, you know, it was.
And I'm now only just beginning to understand this, which is that circumnavigation isn't simply, you know, cutting a lap.
Yeah.
Right? It's not cutting a lap of the continent. Circumnavigation for Flinders isn't like chucking a donut around the continent. It involves engaging perhaps a little more deeply with the coastline.
Indeed. It's not just hooning.
Yeah.
So now it's 1803 and he's unable to find another vessel fit for further exploration. So instead, he decides to head home to his wife, Anshima.
Sorry. Wife? Was I so obsessed with the Bass Timothy Chalamet romance story that I didn't hear about the wife, or have we actually not heard about the wife yet?
Look, you said that, Lee. We have actually heard about the wife.
Yep.
We heard about the wife in episode
did
one.
We?
You know, fair enough, we did gloss over her. So let's go a little bit deeper into Anne. She moves in the same circles as his family in Donnington. Mm-hmm. Remember, that's on the coast. She's older by 16 months. Love a man who goes for an older lady. Mm-hmm. She corresponded with Flinders from the time that he left New South Wales mm-hmm. in 1795. You know, it's interesting actually thinking of these relationships by today's terms mm-hmm. in that this is a relationship that subsists almost entirely in letters. The courtship is entirely on pen and paper.
Heaven for an historian.
Exactly. It is such a trove. He professed love to her but couldn't marry. He said that he didn't have enough money to be independent, and of course she can't come with him because there are to be no ladies at sea. Mm-hmm. You would think by today's standards that, you know, having an entirely epistolary relationship mm-hmm. might be a bit frustrating. Although that said, when you think about online stuff, you know, I guess there are people who go for quite some time.
Exactly.
Just epistolary
chatting on Grindr for weeks and weeks at a time. Same.
Totally. And by epistolary, we mean
letters, right?
A relationship that subsists in letters. That's right. So writing letters to Anne, Flinders, on the other hand, says just how much he likes it. So he goes, look, writing, and I quote, is like opening my bosom to thee, a friend who can feel and whose sensibility can inhale the rising thought. How comes it that I selected thee of all people in the world for such a recital? He explained that in spite of all the esteem and friendship that he felt for his brother, he would nonetheless feel a repugnance in such a communication. So much do I fancy female sensibility to be superior to that of a man.
Sounds great. Like, oh, you're great, Anne, because you listen to me talk shit.
Well, she's interesting, actually, because she doesn't listen to him talk shit. In fact, what is interesting is that she refuses to respond to the letter where he opens up his heart, mm-hmm. you know, to her. She doesn't respond to that. So, look, Lee, they do actually end up marrying. Mm-hmm. You know, it's tough. There's a lot of back and forth. He sells some property and he's able to support her, basically, mm-hmm. to commit to marriage. But now, let's go back. It's 1803. Mm-hmm. And Flinders, between his various journeys, has finished his circumnavigation of Australia. Mm-hmm. He's nearly 30 and he just wants to get back to wifey. I've read these letters. He's constantly writing back mm-hmm. to her. Like, yes, he's clearly hot for George Bass, mm-hmm. but he hasn't forgotten Anne.
So does he get a good ship to make his way home?
You would hope so, right? But the boat that he first takes home gets wrecked once again off the Great Barrier Reef. So he sails back to Sydney. That's 1,127 kilometres in a cutter, so a very small boat, mm-hmm. which is apparently very impressive, to get help for the maroon crew. And then his bad luck continues because the next ship is crap too. I'm not going to quote the Australian Dictionary of Biography here. He says, The schooner soon proved totally unfit for service, needing almost constant pumping to keep her afloat, as well as being very crank. So he decides to stop in at French-controlled Mauritius for help. He's really got no choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, his ship's crank.
His ship is crank, exactly. And it's a big mistake. War has broken out between Britain and France, unbeknownst to Flinders. So you can imagine he doesn't have his iPhone there. He's not scrolling and checking the news. He hasn't realised this. And the problem for him is not just that war's broken out. A scientific passport should protect him from that. But his scientific passport was given to him in England and it references a ship that he no longer has.
Well, he's had to change ships like 7 times.
Exactly. And they haven't updated it. So he pulls in to Mauritius. He's got this leaky, mite-infested vessel and spies are everywhere. And for the governor of Mauritius, a guy called Decon, Flinders looks like a spy.
Sure. So he's read in bad faith.
I thought you were going to say he's read Tom Clancy. No. But maybe the equivalent.
Yeah, the early 19th century equivalent.
Exactly. Look, he has, and he should, it should really have been a very easy matter to resolve, okay? Like, you could have just gone, you know, I've got all these crap ships. All the best ships have gone to war, obviously. Mm-hmm.
Look at me with my maps.
Exactly. I'm a chap with some maps, like, you know, what's to be afraid of? But instead, Flinders is really indignant. And I think it's at this moment that we actually get a real sense of who he is as a person, outside of all the history of circumnavigation, whatever. So first, he has to be asked to remove his hat when addressing Decon. This is incredibly rude, you know, in the 18th, 19th century. He refused his invitation for dinner.
Oh, wow, okay.
So weird, right? And more than that, he wrote him a letter bursting with outrage. Flinders is furious about the fact that he's been immediately suspected to be a spy and he's been taken prisoner. You know, he just thinks, come on, I'm a scientific voyager.
Yep.
And this is what he writes in his letter. He says, I sought protection and assistance in your port, and I have found a prison. And Flinders, just for some context here, he's being melodramatic, obviously. That's Flinders. But think about the way that Boudin was treated when he arrives actually around the same time in Port Jackson in Sydney. You know, you've got Governor King rushing out to him. Sure, his passport also corresponds with the vessel, but, you know, he's really wined and dined and there's a lot of celebration about it.
So Flinders' treatment in Mauritius stands out.
Yeah, but also his reaction to it stands out as wildly undiplomatic. You know, like, he could have just turned up to dinner, taken the hat off, gone. Of course, I understand that you're going to need to investigate this. Once you do, you will see that I'm a scientific navigator.
So obviously you needed bungaree on the ship.
Yes, that's right. This, now we understand, beyond all the other reasons, why Flinders needed bungaree. He was really quite rude. I mean, he's mismanaged things. It's not great. He's in a cell. But don't worry. He starts to kind of claw his way back. Things start to look a bit brighter for him. And by 1804, the year he turns 30, he's actually being held in what's described as a garden prison.
Oh, that sounds nice. Tell me more about this.
Look, it's not bad. And he himself says, before breakfast, my time is devoted to the Latin language. After breakfast, I'm employed making out a fair copy of the investigator's log in lieu of my own, which was spoiled at the shipwreck. When tired of writing, I apply to music. And when my fingers are tired with the flute, I write again until dinner. I just love how foppy she is. So in late 1805, he's permitted to live in the countryside with Louise d'Arrifat and her 3 daughters and 2 young sons. They've got this very lovely place. And look, his life continues to sound kind of idyllic. He says, at 9 we sup and at 10 we retire to bed, where the agreeable employments of the day often occupy so much of my thoughts as to prevent me from sleeping. Are you prevented from sleeping, Lee? Often when you've got a crush.
I was going to say when you're obsessed.
Exactly. So part of this, I think, is because he does have a massive crush on the eldest daughter, Delphine.
He's addicted to crushes.
I actually think that that is a good historical analysis. He has crushes on so many people, so many things. I think Flinders finds it very difficult to describe any kind of relationship, even liking something, without putting it in extreme romantic terms.
And crushes are fun.
Yep.
Like, it's a fun vibe to be in. I get it.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a drama. And you can imagine how boring his life is otherwise. He actually wants to be back in Britain. But he writes of Delphine in his diary, "She's indeed an extraordinary young lady, possessing a strength of mind, a resolution, and a degree of penetration which few men can boast of." I don't want to paint all this period as just him romping around playing the flute, you know, bathing in creeks and falling in love with Delphine. He really does plunge into depression at this time. He plots escape. It wouldn't have been that difficult. He decides against it, basically because he wants to leave Mauritius with his honour. He wants it to be completely legal. And he does finally leave Mauritius. The French government release him and Flinders gets back to England in 1810. And he's 36 years old. So remember, he was that determined little 27-year-old when he set out on his great exploration in 1801. And he hasn't seen Anne in 9 years. He gets back to England. He's in poor health. But he does get to work on his magnum opus, which is a book and an atlas of Australia. And really catchy title of his book. I could see it, you know, just jumping off the shelves of bookstores today. And stay with me here. I'm going to take a deep breath. A Voyage to Terra Australis, undertaken for the purpose of completing the discovery of that vast country and prosecuted in the years 1801, 1802 and 1803 in His Majesty's ship, the Investigator, and subsequently in the armed vessel Porpoise and Cumberland Schooner. With an account of the shipwreck, with an account of the shipwreck of the Porpoise, arrival of the Cumberland at Mauritius, and imprisonment of the commander during 6.5 years in that island.
So we're done? Okay, so we're done. he read Cook's account of his own expedition. Is he casting himself in this vein of, you know, amazing explorers who are then going to write about their exploits to a thrilled British reading public?
Without a doubt, there's a few different audiences for him. He definitely, there's a heroic vein, as you've noticed. There's a scientific vein to it. He has completed the circumnavigation of Australia. For the first time, we have a map of that. But yeah, I mean, if we go back to little young Flinders there in Donnington, dreaming about, you know, having read Robinson Crusoe, dreaming about a life in the Navy, achieving fame, fortune, celebrity. Yeah, this is the moment. It's happening to him. The problem is that he is really sick when he's doing this. He's in such poor health and he's actually dying. And he does die in 1814 at the age of 40 of renal failure. He'd been working on this magnum opus, and the day after the book and the atlas were published, that's the day that he breathes his last breath.
This is a novel.
Isn't it extraordinary?
You know, just the timing. It's just, you know, the poetry of it.
Right. It's such a deathbed scene. Yeah. I just always imagine it. I always imagine him lying down and actually cradling or hugging his voyages. I'm not sure whether that's true. Maybe he was probably hugging Anne. But
we've got Flinders dead at 40, having achieved what seems to me to be some pretty amazing things. And I'm sitting here 200 years later, lots of Flinders landmarks. I now know something different about Bass Strait that I didn't know before, which is going to change my relationship to my hometown.
Bass not so straight.
Yeah. But I want to know how you think about Flinders, Alicia. Like, what do you think he tells us that is important about this period of history?
Look, I get the historical, you know, thing. I think circumnavigating Australia is absolutely, you know, that's an achievement.
It's an accomplishment.
That's fair enough. For me personally, I really like him as an exemplar of a particular version of masculinity which I think rubs up against the kinds of masculinity that we celebrate in Australia. So often here, we instead have these hyper-masculine figures who we celebrate. So it could be the Bushman, it could be the Anzac, it could be the larrikin, it could be the surfer who is always imagined to be male, or the sports stars. And these I think we tell ourselves too often in our national mythos, are these real men who prove their masculinity through physical feats.
You know, there's a lot of statues of Flinders around. I think it would be really easy to insert Flinders into that pantheon of blokey national mythos. And what I really love about having heard about Flinders from you, Alicia, is that you've kind of taken him out of that and placed him into a different context and given me a sense of him as a sort of late 18th century figure who can't be understood in that framework. And we've got to give him his own time and place. And in a sense, he's a founding father, right? Or we could see him as a founding father of kind of colonial Australia or settler Australia. I sort of don't hate the idea of having a founding father who's a bit curious. And that's not to say he's without politics. That's not to say he's without, you know, a kind of hierarchical relationship. But he is a different kind of person to put at the centre of a national story, I think. And I'm intrigued by what he might open out for us. I think it's really interesting and fun.
Absolutely, yeah.
So
you're partial to the daddies too anyway,
Luke. I really am. and, you know, particularly a complex daddy who's got his own daddy issues going on, which he clearly did. Mm. But we're directing a Flinders biopic. What's its tagline, Alicia?
Oh, God, Lee. I mean, I guess if it was going to be a romance, which I kind of feel like it should be, you could call it something like foppish, fabulous and very fluid.
Yeah, there we go. And playing the flute.
Foppish, fabulous, flautist and fluid. Love it.
Oh, Alicia, it's been a joy gossiping about Matthew Flinders with you.
I have found it absolutely delightful.
If you know someone who loves history or gossip, or just two historians letting loose in an ABC studio, share The Dead Can't Sue with them.
And if you have someone you want us to do an episode about, then send an email to thedeadcan'tsue@abc.net.au.
The Dead Can't Sue is an ABC Audio Studios podcast made on the lands of the Kulin Nation and on Gadigal Country.
It's produced by supervising producer Hannah Riche with executive producers Claire Rawlinson and Eric George. Beverly Wang was the development producer and Jessica Radburn is the head of audio on demand. Engineering by Brendan O'Neill. We've chucked a bunch of links to our sources in the show notes, so go on, do some further reading. We dare you.
I'm Lee Boucher, Associate Professor at Macquarie University.
And I'm Alicia Simmons, Associate Professor at UTS.
And we can't wait to gossip about the dead again with you next week.